You stay with me on the jetway to report what happened. You're an impartial voice in all of this. The police will listen to you. They'll arrest that fat creep for pouring his beer on me, and he can enjoy the end of the world from a dank little cell crammed in with shitty raving drunks. She has shut her eyes, trying to place herself back in the wedding garden. She wants to stand by the man-made river and turn her head and see her father on the bridge again. She doesn't want to be afraid of him this time. She wants to make eye contact and smile back. But she isn't going to get to stay in her wedding garden of the mind. Feidelman's voice has been rising along with his hysteria. The big man across the aisle, Bobby, catches the last of what he has to say.
While you're making your statement to the police, Bobby says, I hope you won't leave out the part where you called my wife smug and ignorant.
Bobby, says the big man's wife, the little woman with adoring eyes, don't. Ara lets out a long, slow breath and says, no one is going to report anything to police in Fargo.
You're wrong about that,
Feidelman says, his voice shaking. His legs are shaking too. No, Ara says, I'm not. I'm sure of it.
Why are you so sure?
Asks Bobby's wife. She has bright, bird-like eyes and quick, bird-like gestures. Because we aren't landing in Fargo. The plane stopped circling the airport a few minutes after the missiles launched. Didn't you notice? We left our holding pattern some time ago. Now we're headed north.
How do you know that? Asks the little woman.
The sun is on the left side of the plane. Hence, we go north. Bobby and his wife look out the window. The wife makes a low hum of interest and appreciation.
What's north of Fargo? The wife asks. And why would we go there?
Bobby slowly lifts a hand to his mouth, a gesture which might indicate he's giving the matter his consideration, but which Ara sees as Freudian. He already knows why they aren't landing in Fargo, and has no intention of saying. Ara only needs to close her eyes to see in her mind exactly where the warheads must be now, well outside of the Earth's atmosphere, already past the crest of their deadly parabola, and dropping back into gravity's well. There is perhaps less than 10 minutes before they strike the other side of the planet. Ara saw at least 30 missiles launch, which is 20 more than are needed to destroy a nation smaller than New England. And the 30 they have all witnessed rising to the sky are certainly only a fraction of the arsenal that has been unleashed. Such an onslaught can only be met with a proportional response, and no doubt America's ICBMs have crossed paths with hundreds of rockets sailing the other way. Something has gone horribly wrong, as was inevitable when the fuse was lit on this string of geopolitical firecrackers. But Ara does not close her eyes to picture strike and counterstrike. She prefers instead to return to Jeju. Carp riot in the river, the fragrant evening smells of lusty blossoms and fresh-cut grass. Her father puts his elbows on the stone wall of the bridge and grins mischievously.
This guy, says Feidelman, this guy and his goddamn wife calls Asians Orientals? Talks about how your people are ants? Bullies people by throwing beer at them. This guy and his goddamn wife put reckless, stupid people just like themselves in charge of this country, and now here we are. The missiles are flying.
His voice cracks with strain, and Ara senses how close he is to crying. She opens her eyes once more. This guy and his goddamn wife are on the plane with us. We're all on this plane. She looks over at Bobby and his wife, who are listening to her.
However we got here, we're all on this plane now. In the air, in trouble, running as hard as we can.
She smiles. It feels like her father's smile.
Next time you feel like throwing a beer, give it to me instead. I could use something to drink.
Bobby stares at her for an instant with thoughtful, fascinated eyes, then laughs.
Bobby's wife looks up at him and says, "Why are we running north? Do you really think Fargo could be hit? Do you really think we could be hit here, over the middle of the United States?"
Her husband doesn't reply. so she looks back at Ara. Ara weighs in her heart whether the truth would be a mercy or yet another assault. Her silence, however, is answer enough. The woman's mouth tightens. She looks at her husband and says, "If we're going to die, I want you to know I'm glad I'll be next to you when it happens. You were good to me, Robert Jeremy Slate." He turns to his wife and kisses her and draws back and says, "Are you kidding me? I can't believe a fat man like me wound up married to a knockout like you. It'd be easier to draw a $1 million lottery ticket." Feitelman stares at them and then turns away. "Oh, for fuck's sake, don't start being human on me now." He crumples up a beery paper towel and throws it at Bob Slate. It bounces off Bobby's temple. The big man turns his head and looks at Feitelman and laughs warmly. Ara closes her eyes, puts her head against the back of her seat. Her father watches her approach the bridge through the silky spring night. As she steps up to the stone arch, he reaches out to take her hand and lead her on to an orchard where people are dancing. Kate Bronson in the cockpit. By the time Kate finishes field dressing Vorstenbosch's head injury, the flight attendant is groaning, stretched out on the cockpit floor. She tucks his glasses into his shirt pocket. The left lens was cracked in the fall. "I have never, ever lost my footing," Vorstenbosch says, "in 20 years of doing this. I am the Fred effing Astaire of the skies. No, the Grace effing Kelly. I can do the work of all other flight attendants, but backward and in heels." Kate says, "I've never seen a Fred Astaire film. I was always more of a Sly Stallone girl." "Surf," Vorstenbosch says. "Right to the bone," Kate agrees and squeezes his hand. "Don't try to get up, not yet." Kate springs lightly to her feet and slips into the seat beside Waters. When the missiles launched, the imaging system lit up with bogeys, 100 red pinpricks and more. But there's nothing now except the other planes in the immediate vicinity. Most of the other aircraft are behind them, still circling Fargo. Captain Waters turned them to a new heading while Kate tended to Vorstenbosch. "What's going on?" she asks. His face alarms her. He's so waxy, he's almost colorless.
"It's all happening," he says. "The president has been moved to a secure location. The cable news says Russia launched."
"Why?" she asks, as if it matters. He shrugs helplessly, but then replies,
"Russia or China or both put defenders in the air to turn back our bombers before they could get to Korea. A sub in the South Pacific responded by striking a Russian aircraft carrier, and then.
"So," Kate says,
"no Fargo."
"Where?" Kate can't seem to load more than a single word at a time. There is an airless, tight sensation behind her breastbone.
"There must be somewhere north we can land away from what's coming down behind us. There must be somewhere that isn't a threat to anyone. Nunavut, maybe? They landed a 777 in Iqaluit last year. Short little runway at the end of the world, but it's technically possible, and we might have enough fuel to make it."
"Silly me," Kate says. "I didn't think to pack a winter coat."
He says, "You must be new to long-haul flying. You never know where they're going to send you, so you always make sure you have a swimsuit and mittens in your bag."
She is new to long-haul flying. She attained her 777 rating just 6 months ago. She doesn't think Waters' tip is worth taking to heart. Kate doesn't think she'll ever fly another commercial aircraft. Neither will Waters. There won't be anywhere to fly to. Kate isn't going to see her mother, who lives in Pennsylvania, ever again, but that's no loss. Her mother will bake, along with the stepfather who tried to put a hand down the front of Kate's Wranglers when she was 14. When Kate told her mom what he had tried to do, her mother said it was her own fault for dressing like a slut. Kate will also never see her 12-year-old half-brother again, and that does make her sad. Liam is sweet, peaceful, and autistic. Kate got him a drone for Christmas, and his favorite thing in the world is to send it aloft to take aerial photographs. She understands the appeal.
That has always been her favorite part of getting airborne, too, that moment when the houses shrink to the size of models on a train set. Trucks the size of ladybugs gleam and flash as they slide frictionless along the highways. Altitude reduces lakes to the size of flashing silver hand mirrors. From a mile up, a whole town is small enough to fit in the cup of your palm. Her half-brother Liam says he wants to be little, like the people in the pictures he takes with his drone. He says if he was as small as them, Kate could put him in her pocket and take him with her. They soar over the northernmost edge of North Dakota, gliding in the way she once sliced through the bathwater warm water off Phi-Phi Beach, through the glassy bright green of the Pacific. How good that felt, to sail as if weightless above the ocean world beneath. To be free of gravity is, she thinks, to feel what it must be like to be pure spirit, to escape the flesh itself. Minneapolis calls out to them.
Delta 236, you are off course. You are about to vacate our airspace. What's your heading?
Minneapolis, Water says, our heading is 060. Permission to redirect to Yankee Foxtrot Bravo Iqaluit Airport.
Delta 236, why can't you land at Fargo?
Waters bends over the controls for a long time. A drop of sweat plinks on the dash. His gaze shifts briefly, and Kate sees him looking at the photograph of his wife.
Minneapolis, Fargo is a first strike location. We'll have a better chance north. There are 247 souls on board.
The radio crackles. Minneapolis considers. There is a snap of intense brightness, almost blinding, as if a flashbulb the size of the sun has gone off somewhere in the sky behind the plane. Kate turns her head away from the windows and shuts her eyes. There is a deep muffled whump, felt more than heard, a kind of existential shudder in the frame of the aircraft. When Kate looks up again, there are green blotchy afterimages drifting in front of her eyeballs. It's like diving Phi-Phi again. She is surrounded by neon fronds and squirming fluorescent jellyfish. Kate leans forward and cranes her neck. Something is glowing under the cloud cover, possibly as much as 100 miles away behind them. The cloud itself is beginning to deform and expand, bulging upward. As she settles back into her seat, there is another deep, jarring, muffled crunch, another burst of light. The inside of the cockpit momentarily becomes a negative image of itself. This time she feels a flash of heat against the right side of her face, as if someone switched a sun lamp on and off.
Minneapolis says, copy Delta 236. Contact Winnipeg Center 127.3. The air traffic controller speaks with an almost casual indifference.
Vorstenbosch sits up.
I'm seeing flashes. Us too,
Kate says. Oh my God. Water says. His voice cracks. I should have tried to call my wife. Why didn't I try to call my wife? She's 5 months pregnant and she's all alone.
You can't, Kate says. You couldn't.
Why didn't I call and tell her? Water says, as if he hadn't heard.
She knows, Kate tells him. She already knows. Whether they are talking about love or the apocalypse, Kate couldn't say. Another flash. Another deep, resonant, meaningful thump.
Call now Winnipeg FIR, says Minneapolis. Call now NAV Canada. Delta 236.
You are released.
Copy, Minneapolis, Kate says, because Waters has his face in his hands and is making tiny, anguished sounds and can't speak.
Thank you. Take care of yourselves, boys. This is Delta 236. We're gone.
Warbirds by David J. Scow. David Scow is perhaps best known for his work in the splatterpunk subgenre. He is said to have invented the word, but he has also written straight fiction, crime stories, and screenplays which include The Crow and the best of the Texas Chainsaw Massacre reboots, The Texas Chainsaw Massacre: The Beginning, for those of you keeping score. Warbirds is a stunning and amazingly detailed recreation of the bombing runs over Germany in World War II. It's also a powerful portrait of the forces that are unleashed when men go to war.
I think we woke something up back then with all that conflict, old Jorgensen says. All that hate. All those lives.
Which may or may not explain what the crew of the Shady Lady saw while the bullets were flying and the air was exploding all around them.
Warbirds. Read by Santino Fontana.
Warbirds was real, said the old man sitting across the table from me. I seen 'em. More real than gremlins, say. Less real than the weight of a pistol in your hand. I had traveled several hundred miles to listen to this man reminisce about my late father, and he was spinning me a tale of flying monsters, his spidery white eyebrows gauging how much hogwash I might buy. We'd never met before, and all the trust assumed implicit between us was mere courtesy, standing at ease until something more fundamental could replace it. I should have paid more attention to that part about the pistol.
Good man, your dad, said Jorgensen. Top turret gunner.
That would be the Martin turret on the B-24D. Blame my homework. I knew each crew member by their position. I'd based a lot of my anticipation on a photo I found from 1943, one of the few times the entire core team held together long enough for a snapshot. I appended last names to each man, my roster denying them their full names or nicknames, and back then everybody had a nickname, usually a diminution of their given name. Bobby, Willie, Frankie. No different from kids in a neighborhood mob. And kids these guys were. As I sat there drinking coffee served by Jorgensen's sister Katie, that defocused black-and-white photo was 65 years old, and most of the fresh faces were barely out of their teens. At least two of the crew had lied about their age in order to join up. Jorgensen today was not pushing 80, he was pulling it. One more burden. He suffered arthritis that had closed his hands to cramped claws. He wouldn't admit that he was a bit deaf, even though his hearing aid was plain to see. One of the older, bigger ones, a behind-the-ear rig with a so-called flesh-colored braided wire that snaked to a box stationed in his shirt pocket. His eyes were blue, paled by a patina of yellowed sclera. Polished spectacles. He was bowed but unbent by time and expected me to believe what he told me because, after all, he was my elder, and what do kids really know anyway? Brett Jorgensen, like most men in bomber crews during World War II, had come out of training and landed in Europe as a sergeant. He joked that before the Normandy invasion, German prison camps were overcrowded with thousands of shot-down sergeants. He leaked items like this to suss me out. Was I for real? Did I know what I was talking about? Or was I just another ground pounder who had seen fit to drop the last great war from history and memory? Sergeants and lieutenants, I said, dumping powdered chemicals into my lukewarm coffee. Jorgensen drank his straight, black, naturally. If you repeat what a person tells you, usually they illuminate. He pushed back from our table, then moved forward. He had a tough time finding biz to do with his hands, since they had degenerated to basic grasping tools. I felt a sympathetic twinge, not for the first time.
Your dad was a sergeant, too, out of Chicago. He tried to train on AT-6s, but wasn't a very good pilot. He pulled back of the bus, twin 50s.
He snorted out a chuckle and searched for a napkin.
This one time, he got his butt cooked by a piece of flak that came through the fuselage and tore through his flight suit and wound up sizzling against his ass.
Yeah, he told me about that one. Bernburg Airport, part of Berlin's outer ring of protective bases. Mission number 3, March of 44.
You have been paying attention, Jorgensen said. Well then, maybe you won't find this story so weird. You've seen war movies. Ever seen combat?
No, sir. I was in high school when the draft lottery was instigated. I drew a fairly high number on first call.
Well, it ain't like that. And aerial combat is a whole different gorilla. Mostly what it is a lot of noise and panic, and somehow, if you live through it, you try to figure out later why you're not dead. In the moment, it's all adrenaline and the kind of fear that makes you shit yourself. Planes coming apart around you, bomb loads dropping, 10 big 50s all snackering away, enemy fighters throwing 20-millimeter cannon shells at your snoot, and around you, all around you, you see other planes going down. Guys you knew, trailing smoke, blowing up in midair, and you want to look for chutes, but there's no time. You ever listen to that heavy metal music?
He painted such a vivid thumbnail that I was momentarily lost in it, groundless. What? Oh yeah, some, you know.
I never liked it, said Jorgensen.
Pause for me to construct a mental image of Jorgensen sitting down all cozy with a Black Sabbath Greatest Hits disc. A taste of Mudhoney Thrash. Perhaps a jot of some Norwegian speed metal band's idea of Meltdown.
Know why? It sounds like combat. That's why.
The B-24 Liberator, called the Turk, according to its nose paint, chomped into the ground and belched flaming parts all over the runway shoulder while what was left of her crew scattered. Two crewmen, still in thermal suits, were flattened by the explosion. One did not get up to slap himself out. Fire crews hustled from one half-extinguished conflagration to this new one as other crippled heavies tried to dodge the debris and land. Liberators, 19 tons each, empty, were packed and stacked on approach and literally dropping out of the sky. A tower spotter was busy counting returning planes and racking up a death toll. The weather, typical for England, was an oppressive haze of fog and overcast. Blazing planes seared painfully bright peepholes in the mist, hot spots that corkscrewed black contrails of smoke toward the sky. Wheatrow, a just-arrived belly gunner from Oklahoma City, as blonde and corn-fed as his name, rushed up to Harry Mars, a lieutenant who was the Shady Lady's co-pilot. Mars stood with his hands thrust into his back pockets, an attitude he affected when he had no idea of what to fix first.
"Jesus H. Christ," said Wheatrow. "What hit her?"
"Came in with her nose wheel cocked and didn't watch the crash film, I guess," said Mars. "Welcome to Shipdom, laddie buck." Shipdom was a parish in Norfolk, a jut of the Isles northeast of London, now home to the 44th Bomb Group and one of the Allies' coastal rally points for European missions. This British postcard of pubs and cottages had been despoiled by Nissen huts and landing strips, and girded by anti-aircraft batteries, then overrun by brash American flyers demanding to know what was really going on, usually loudly and with a pointed absence of tact. Cultural shock writ large. Watching a gutshot B-24 slide home was almost operatic in its extravagant horror. Liberators were big-bellied birds that ceased to look ungainly only in flight. On water ditches, they tended to squash, making survival 10 times less likely than if you splashed a flying fort. The Turk's skipper took the lousy hand he had been dealt and played it by the manual, feathering his 2 working engines, stomping flaps, and keeping his snout off the tarmac as long as possible. His locked-down starboard wheel had snapped on impact, guttering him into the mud and shearing off the right wing between the huge Pratt Whitney engines. Then something had caught fire. No bomb load, little ammo, and littler fuel but something aboard had touched off and blew the beast apart at the waist like a firecracker in a beer bottle. Practically everything aboard these planes was flammable anyway, and the fire would not be extinguished by the United Kingdom's omnipresent cold, gray mud, and moisture-laden air. Everybody got more bad news from Madsen in the mess hall, which doubled as the briefing shack. Wheatrow checked the mission board for Shady Lady. Their space was still blank. Madsen was a stiff piece of Sam Brown-belted British business, with a swagger stick he employed as a pointer and map-whacking tool, addressing a full complement of fidgeting officers and non-coms in the too small corrugated hut. A total of 109.2 tons of 501,000-pound bombs, fused at 1/10 of a second nose and 1/4 second tail, were successfully dropped from 18,000 to 20,000 feet, apart from the Messerschmitt plant at Regensburg. Madsen's swagger stick whacked the map and a general cheer went up at this. Yes. Yes. Madsen waited it out. Two other targets in the vicinity were hit, successfully severing air, water, and electrical lines, a screw factory, and a rubber plant. Of course, some machine parts were left salvageable, but not without major testing and repair. Nearly 900 lit cigarettes formed an inversion layer of smoke in the dome of the hut. Wheatrow recognized a few faces fresh from his training in Casper, Wyoming. Guys he'd shipped over with, guys with unmemorable names. But now he was socked in with his new crew, the fresh meat on their plate. He sat next to Sergeant Jorgensen, who was rocking in his folding chair. "All this Limey ever talks about," said Jorgensen, "screwing in rubbers." Alvin Tukes, a cowboy from California, leaned in from Jorgensen's far side to jerk a thumb toward the Shady Lady's navigator. "Old Lieutenant Max, he married a Limey almost as soon as he hit the beach. Ba-boom!" Tukes immediately cringed under the scrutiny of Lieutenant Keith Stackpole, bombardier and nose gunner. He was, after all, talking about an officer. "Shit," he said. "Sorry, sir." Stackpole, one of the grown-ups among them at age 22, held out a flat hand. "Keep that blather stowed." Just as they were raiding the Axis, a similarly militant contingent of British ladies were raiding homesick Yanks in a potent atmosphere of material privation and imminent death. Max Gentry, their green-eyed navigator, had claimed different. He had fallen in love. Of course. He had also bought himself a double truckload of ribbing and bullshit, which Stackpole admired him for bearing with a calm deference that suggested he was acclimating to the whole indigenous stiff upper lip posture. As long as Gentry did not start wearing a flight scarf or speaking with a nasal accent, Stackpole would be A-OK with the ladies map man. Stackpole passed a cigarette to Sergeant Jones, the radio man, who broke it in half and passed it on to Sergeant Smith, his best buddy, engineer and right-waist gunner. Smith and Jones. Sometimes he had to laugh to keep from crying.
"To hell with all the scores," Jones groused. "How many?"
40, 50, something like that," said Smith. Both men lit up off the same match. Wheatrow's expression curdled. "Out of how many?"
200, something like that."
Jimmy Beck had appeared behind them since there were no more seats. The tail gunner wore military-issue glasses and transferred his smoke from one hand to the other to permit Lieutenant Mars and their pilot, Lieutenant Coggins, to squeeze in. Every fact and statistic, no matter how clear, was something like that. Wheatrow lost his breath.
200?
"Out of a total of 177 B-24s. Madsen boomed from the paltry little stage up front. "At least 127, possibly as many as 133, reached and bombed the target. 42 aircraft were shot down or crashed en route." "En route?" said Tukes, still with a newcomer's fascination at the British penchant for not speaking English.
"Of which 15, we estimate, were lost over the target."
"We're not on the mission board again," Coggins said to Stackpole.
"In addition," said Madsen, "8 planes landed in neutral Turkey and were interned. 104 returned to base, and 23 to other friendly bases for a total loss of 50. The casualty tallies at present are 440 men killed or missing in action. We are informed the Axis holds 20 of the missing crews. Wheatrow felt his stomach drop away. One mission, nearly 450 guys lost. The crews of 45 lost planes. Something like that. Goddamn krauts, Jorgensen muttered. Madsen delivered the cold comfort part of the briefing. A total of 51 enemy fighters were downed. Great, said Tukes. Almost one fighter for every bomber full of guys. Some of the men applauded anyway. Lieutenant Mars was already past it, ribbing Beck. Hey, Jimmy, know what the life expectancy is for a tail gunner in combat? It was an ancient joke for these youngsters. At least three of them chimed. 9 seconds! Thanks, fellas, said Beck, exhaling smoke. I feel a whole lot better. Warm inside. Coggins silently scoped reaction among his crew. Good. Big death numbers would make them all hate the Fuhrer a little more tomorrow. And maybe that hate could help him bring them all back alive. Not barbecued in bomber wreckage like those poor sons of bitches aboard the Turk, whose skipper was currently logging bunk time in the hospital with his left arm deep-fried medium rare and his leg busted in four places. This was war. This was important. In 1941, 6 months before Pearl Harbor, the U.S. Army Air Corps had been renamed U.S. Army Air Forces under General Hap Arnold. And this hut full of belligerent Americans had a lot to stand up for, tons to prove. Now, their pride was pricked every day. The Warriors of the Clouds were almost as legitimate and autonomous as the Navy or the tank jockeys. After the states entered the fray, the War Department reorganized the Army Ground Forces and Army Air Forces into co-equal commands. But the shuffle would not result in something called the United States Air Force until after the war. Many of the veteran flyers still wore their Air Corps insignia with understandable self-esteem, even though they were all now part of the AAF. The pride did not count for much when you were rousted out of your rack at 1 o'clock in the morning. Half the guys in the hut were aware of the intruder even before he clicked on his flashlight. That would be Carlisle, the CO. So that would be Carlisle's beam bouncing off Coggins' bald cue ball skull in the chilly darkness. Coggins, Carlisle whispered. JJ, wakey, wakey. I'm awake, Coggins husked, rolling over. Carlisle seated himself on the edge of the cot. Listen, I hate to do this to you, but... What time is it? Everybody, except Tukes, was awake now. 1:15. Look. The mission. Can you make it? Sure, said Coggins, as if he were sure of everything. We're leading the 8th this morning, and we need the whole group to muster maximum effort. What's he saying? Said Wheatrow, rubbing his face to consciousness. Shh, said Beck. It's a surprise. It's a big deal, said Carlisle, louder now for the general benefit. Heavy flak, then fighters. An oil refinery. I know your crew isn't quite combat ready, but we can't co-pilot you out with a more experienced guy because my crew is combat ready, sir. Coggins returned and nobody contradicted him. There it was then. The thing Coggins would later describe as a massacre. Coggins had gotten Shady Lady painted on his ship during his North African leg. This green crew was sleeping inside a hut that several days before had been occupied by a completely different crew, now MIA. Tomorrow? Who knew? Technically, they had flown 4 of their 25 mission stint, but had always been recalled or otherwise aborted. They had yet to make it all the way across the channel. Their much-vaunted first mission had decayed into a complete embarrassment when they lost a supercharger at 12,000 feet and had to turn back and dump their bombs in the North Atlantic. Their right-waist gunner, a Texan named McArdle, had been seconded out to an active combat crew on their 12th run, hometown gal,
leaving a slot that had just been filled by Wheatrow. A belly gunner from a ship called the Double Diamond had related the mission to Coggins. I saw the Rat Packer take an 88 shell right in the cockpit. It heeled over with a full load of bombs and cut hometown gal right in half. I didn't see any chutes. Was McArdle alive or dead? Nobody knew. And past a certain minimal concern, it was a bad idea to care too much. So here they were, scalding hot coffee, joints cracking in the accursed British damp, struggling into their gear, sleep dirt blurring their vision, becoming roly-poly flyboys. Electrical suits, flak vests, backpack chutes for the pilots, chest chutes for the rest, Mae Wests, helmets, goggles, oxygen masks. They all smelled like wet sheepskin and leather. "Goddamned fog," said Tukes on the truck to the field. "Too thin to eat and too thick to drink." Visibility was zilch. "We're going to have to follow a jeep just to find the runway," said Stackpole. "Where are we in the formation?" "Coffin corner," said Coggins, trying to make it sound normal. "Oh, outstanding," grumbled Beck, the guy in back. "What?" said Wheatrow, damp blonde hair plastered to his head inside his flight cap. Lieutenant Mars recited the verdict. "Outside edge of the box, rear element." "So the flak can kill us easier," noted Beck. Jorgensen boffed Wheatrow on one thickly padded arm. "Newcomer position, for virgins." "We're supposed to tag along until there's an abort," said Coggins, "so we can fill in." At least they had graduated from the aborts. Coggins had pulled the wire from the brim of his garrison cap with pliers to permit the proper mission crush when he donned his headphones. Stackpole was whistling "The Way You Look Tonight." And Shady Lady abruptly loomed up before them, filling their world. Dull green, bitch mother, sky lover, their womb, their fate. The 44th Bomb Group was known as the Flying Eight Balls, the first Liberator unit in the AAF, though not the first to Europe, which distinction went to the 9th Air Force's Pyramiders. The Eight Balls flew their first sortie in support of flying forts in November of 42, and as the other groups converted to night missions, the Eight Balls were left in the unenviable position of being the sole Liberator group assigned to daylight bombing raids. There was a lot of talk about one Lib, Boomerang by name, part of the 93rd Bomb Group's October 9th raid on Lille. She came back wearing thousands of holes, destined for scrap. But her pilot and crew chief fought for her, patched up her bullet punctures with aluminum, and she became the first B-24 in the 8th to complete her 50 missions. Her men defended her honor, and she repaid them with their lives. "Not to put too fine a point on it," snickers aside, "the Lille mission was also the breaking point for command, which was compelled to incontrovertibly report that the B-24 was a better bombardment craft, hands down, than the much sexier, glamour girl B-17. The Libs were faster, longer range, capable of ferrying heavier bomb loads with superior armament." In essence, the history of the Eight Balls was the saga of the Liberator in wartime. Aerial conflict had birthed her, and she would be practically obsolete by VJ Day. Many of the 24s at Shipdom had arrived with the newer armor, self-sealing tanks, turbo superchargers, and the retractable Sperry Ball turret, which is where Wheatrow was headed this morning. "Big pot-bellied bitch," said Mars, echoing the words of a skipper named Keith Schuyler. "I like big women," said Tukes. "More to grab onto." "She moves fast for a biggin," said Coggins. He might have been talking about his wife back in the States, or his aircraft, thought Jorgensen, like the difference mattered. Maybe his old lady's wingspan was longer than her fuselage. The flight crew had completed hoisting 500-pounders into the lady's bomb bay, and the 1050s aboard were glutted with 11,000 rounds of ammo in disintegrating link belts. Coggins' men began levering themselves into the underside of the plane. There they'd spend the next 12 hours in almost unbearable cramp, pissing through relief tubes, sucking artificial air, fighting not to die. God help you if you were struck with the trots in mid-mission. Mars clambered into the co-pilot bucket to Coggin's right, noting that the skipper, as usual, had locked his seat full forward. You'd think shorter men would be ideal for bombers, but the jokers back in San Diego or Fort Worth always liked to rack the pedals just out of reach for an average human being. "Could be a milk run," Mars said, snugging in. "Could be a nightmare if fighters pick our group to plaster," said Coggins, not looking at him. He mashed down his now wireless cap to accommodate his headphones. They ran through the pre-flight check with the flight engineer. Mars stowed the control latch overhead so it would not slap him in the face later, and popped out the hatch to check movement on the ailerons, elevators, and rudder. They were starting up from a battery cart, so he killed the ignition switches. The engineer pulled the props through by hand, 6 turns or blades each, starting with number 3, inboard to outboard. The process was dull, administrative, and by rote. But even a misstep at this stage could cause an explosion from a closed intercooler or an overlooked supercharger switch. The flight engineer placed the wheel chocks and stood by with the portable extinguisher for the actual engine startup. Number 3 first, to drive the hydraulics. At 1,000 RPM, the dials read properly. 45 to 50 pounds for the oil pressure, 4.5 inches for the vacuum pumps, about 975 pounds pressure in the accumulators for braking power. Coggins throttled to 1/3 power while Mars amplified the fuel mix to auto lean. After taxiing out, Mars would rev all 4 powerhouses to exercise the props. Coggins went on the air. Checking in a phone. "Christ, I can't even see past the nose of the plane," Mars returned as the crew began to check in from their positions. As usual, the fog would lift only when they broke above it. Stackpole's voice. "Bombardier Roger." He was down by their feet near Jones at the radio station, who said, "Radio man, check." Behind Smith always came Jones. "Roger, left waist." "Roger Dodger, you old codger." That was Tukes, across from Smith at the right waist gun. "Top turret Jorgensen here." If Mars or Coggins turned around, they'd see Jorgensen's boots on the turret footbar. "Wheatrow, ball turret is okay." The poor lad had to be dogged in and lowered away without a chute. No room for a chute. To use one, he'd have to clamber out, with help, and strap one on. Theoretically, while the aircraft was plummeting earthward in a fireball. Easy peasy. Lieutenant Gentry jack-in-the-boxed out from his station to give a thumbs up. Per procedure, he had to be heard, so he was.
"Heads up, Jimmy," said Coggins.
"The tail's ready, Skipper," said Beck from what Jorgensen had called the back of the bus.
In that moment, Coggins seemed to compress from the weight he imagined on his yoke. Mars's eyebrows went up. Coggins finally cracked a half-smile and said, "This goddamn seat's too short." Despite their bulky gear, armament, and sleepless disposition, when the lady lofted skyward, it felt like riding in a limousine. They finally got to see some daylight and blue sky. Every little taste of reward was deeply important. At 3,000 feet, they all lit up cigarettes, because at 10,000 feet, they'd have to go on ship oxygen. Then sheer ball sweat would have to carry them until they turned around, empty, and showed the continent their tail.
"We got swamped by Fock Wolves," said Jorgensen. 190s everywhere. After flak always comes fighters. And the next thing I know, Mars is screaming into his intercom that Vargas Dahl was on fire, just off our left wing. I couldn't not see it from my turret. Flak hit an oxygen bottle near old Jonesy's head and blew his radio apart. Wheatrow's electrical suit shorted out and burned him. Everybody's yelling, the guns are all blazing. Fock Wolf's zipping past close enough to spit on. Tuke snapped his gun tether and accidentally shot up our right stabilizer trying to nail one of the sons of bitches, and we started to shake like a drunk old whore. And that's when I saw it. First time.
The warbird, I said. Katie had dutifully refreshed our coffee. Jorgensen's older sister was also in her 80s. The last Mrs. Jorgensen had died a decade ago.
At first, I thought it was one of them Stukas, said Jorgensen. When they dived, they made this weird whine. Then I saw its wings flap, and I thought, this ain't no airplane. It was nearly as big as a fighter. Wings like a bat, snout like one of them needle bills, eyes like onyx and pewter.
He cleared his throat.
About now you're thinking to yourself, gee, this old coot has lost his marbles, right?
His feathery brows arched to indict me. Actually, no, sir. I could never get my father to talk about the war. But some of the Shady Lady's other crew had a few tales to tell. Over the years, it took me to find them. I've heard weirder. He seemed to arrive at some momentous inner decision.
Well, okay then. As long as Katie's in the kitchen or watching soaps or whatever it is she does with her free time.
No protest came from the back of the house, so Jorgensen was satisfied we were in confidence, here.
I thought the same thing you just probably thought.
He went on.
That it was a hallucination. I don't think so. I just saw this big impossible thing coming straight for me. Claws out. Next thing I know, all my plexi is gone and I'm laid out on the deck with my head tore open. Still got the scar.
He smoothed his hair back to favor a white line that zigged from his left eyebrow up into his scalp. It resembled a knife wound.
Damn near lost my eye. By the time we were back to base, I was in shock from loss of blood. I barely remembered the haul back home. They told me later that the belly turret was gone when we landed, and so was Wheatrow, the new guy.
The whole turret was just gone from the plane?
Yeah. Pretty tough to do with just cannon fire or machine guns. And all of us would have felt a direct flak hit. Jerry was using 128mm guns for flak. So if Wheatrow had been blown out of the ball by a burst, we would have known about it because half the plane would have been on fire. We had 7,000 pounds of incendiaries, and our wings were full of high-test gasoline.
You think that... He overrode me.
I don't think. I suspect. Some things I know. Now I suspect what happened to poor old Wheatrow, but I'll tell you what I think. I think that a war that big doesn't just go away because you shake hands and sign some paper.
Or nuke a couple cities into Japanese-flavored vapor. I didn't mean it to sound that flip, but Jorgensen stayed on track, either ignoring it or being polite.
Think of it. The whole world at war. Years of war. Every birthday, every Christmas, the war is still there. Then we suddenly get all civilized and agree to pretend there ain't no war. Sometimes I think. Sometimes.
He petered out. Why bother? He barely knew me. And I was just the callow spawn of one of his old crewmates, Jimmy Beck, who died 5 years ago and never sent a holiday card, ever.
It ain't about heroics or glory,
he said, starting up a different avenue of attack.
Where you're up there in the air, shooting all around, guys bleeding and guys hollering, explosions. It's about keeping your skin on, sheer survival. If you believe in God, you pray constantly to yourself, silently, God, please don't let me die on this mission. If you believe in good luck charms, you tote 'em. Stackpole had a little Kilroy sock doll his wife made for him, and you better believe we all treated Kilroy like one of our crew, made sure he was accounted for on every mission. Gentry had a St. Christopher's medal. Wheatrow came with his rabbit's foot, even though that wasn't very lucky for him.
or the rabbit. And your daddy had this ritual. Before he checked his guns, he'd pull the first slug out of the chain belt and write the date on it and put it in his pocket next to his heart.
A 50 caliber round was nearly 6 inches long and weighed more than a roll of quarters. My father had flown at least 8 successful missions over enemy territory. I wondered what had become of the bullet collection. "Everybody does stuff like that," I said, although my father's quirk was news to me. "You don't need combat to believe in little rituals, patterns. Who does it harm?"
"You're missing the point."
He waved his hand dismissively. I seemed to be part of a larger picture, one that was right behind me, part of a vista that Jorgensen could perceive, but I could not. He was seeing it right now.
"That feeling, that battle feeling, it's come back," he said. "Every day, just little bits at first, more every time. Not flashbacks, not jitters. I'm not senile, goddammit. It's as real as the part in your hair. Now I'm gonna tell you what I believe, and I'll call you a liar if you tell anyone else, but I'm saying this out of respect for your dad."
He was passing something on to me. A weight more massive than I expected. And it was everything I could manage to not interrupt him with all my wise modernity.
"I think we woke something up back then, with all that conflict, all that hate, all those lives feeding the war. Something that big doesn't just stop there one day and gone the next. I think maybe it got gorged in fat and it went to sleep for a while. We had other wars here and there, but they weren't the same. This war had a child. It birthed up something bad. Something that awoke from its nap and realized, why, it was hungry again and it hadn't yanked all of us out of the air where it feeds."
"The warbird. But why you? Why now, after all this time?"
"You want logic from me? I don't have it. All I have is the thought that maybe some of us were supposed to die back then and didn't. And it knows who we are. And it's got a little checklist like a menu. And we're easy pickings because it waited. And now we aren't full of sperm and vinegar anymore. We can't run away and we can't shoot back. The warbird is on the wing again, eating leftovers, and none of this matters because who in hell is gonna believe a crusty old fart like me?"
"Mr. Jorgensen, my father died of a heart attack. A thrombosis. He technically died 4 times before he died for real and stayed that way. He had a quadruple bypass, an angioplasty. He had 2 pacemakers in his chest when he finally went down. Nobody was more stubborn than him when it came to dying, and he did not die in fear or pain. He accepted it. He didn't act like he was..." I hated that I had to grope for an appropriate word. "Haunted."
"Yeah,"
Jorgensen said. There was a hint of gotcha in his eyes. Past the tears, he was manfully damming back. Men of his generation were not supposed to cry, ever.
"But you just said he never talked to you about the war, did he?"
"Yet you talked to me about the warbird. He was not fun in me in the way of a wacky grandpa. He was dead serious. And the admission had cost him in emotional viscera, reeled out and inelegantly splayed for inspection. Whether I was trustworthy or not, I had fallen into that bizarre gap that permits people to confide to strangers intimacies they would never reveal to their closest loved ones. I had gotten an explanation. It seemed unfair to retroactively impose preconditions now."
"I did, didn't I?"
he said, coming back into himself.
"That was stupid of me. I'm sorry, young man. I'm sorry for your dad, and I'm sorry for dumping this on you. You seem like a
stand-up fella. I'd have been proud to serve with you, but please don't let this foolishness hector you none. I'm past it. I'm at the end of my rope, and I'm hearing things every once in a while, and the joke is, I don't even hear so good. Senescence can be liberating. Bet you didn't think I knew a word like senescence. Now did ya? I looked it up.
Sometime later that evening, Brett Jorgensen put the muzzle of a vintage Luger beneath his chin and blew the back of his head apart with a 9mm hollow point. I'd left him alone to do that. Made my excuses, said my goodbyes, and sincerely promised to keep in touch. I had, I realized, abandoned him. From what I could piece together later, he'd had the pistol for over half a century. Brett Jorgensen, the man I had just spoken with, had been the son of immigrant parents from Oslo, Norway. His middle name was Eric. After the war, he had graduated with a degree in political science from the University of Missouri, courtesy of the GI Bill. 2 marriages, 3 children. His obituary would be cursory. He had done time at a brokerage firm and retired with a decent nut. His down-home manner of speech was mostly a put-on. Nobody much cared that he had once risked his life daily to drop fire on the Axis war machine. Since 1939, he had smoked 2 packs of Lucky's a day and never caught a smidge of cancer. Apparently, he had made several attempts at a suicide note and burned them all in a punch bowl-sized ashtray as self-pitying drivel. Near the ashtray and budded smokes was a pewter frame with a photograph of Teresa, his first wife, his big wartime love, his girl back home. He had buried her in 1981 after pathologists dug out a tumor the size of a deflated volleyball from her insides. Against popular odds, he had fallen in love again and ultimately buried his second wife, Millicent, in the same cemetery in New Jersey. The Luger had not come from enemy spoils. Jorgensen had fought Germany in the abstract, but never glimpsed a Nazi, except maybe for one time when he swore he could make out a face, grimacing behind goggles and a leather flight helmet, firing salvos of 20mm cannon fire right at his noggin, 10,000 feet up, lost in foreign clouds. That had been mission number 6, rail yards at Bremen. Or perhaps that cruise had been Hamburg, a munitions factory. Or another kind of factory. Something like that. He never thought he would live to grow old. Yet it was all they ever talked about. Stranded in shipdom, flying missions. Marry that girl back home. Raise that family. Carve out that piece of the red, white, and blue pie. Survive to accomplish it all. He hadn't trusted a politician since Kennedy. He remembered the outrage of the world focusing on that single assassination and recalled where he was and what he was doing when he heard the news. Today, all people knew was that Kennedy had been some kind of randy, dirty joke. Sordid exposés. Muckraking. John F. Kennedy had been a war hero, damn it all to hell. If the revisionism was true, then what had Jorgensen been fighting to preserve way back when? He had seen that cartoon, the one captioned, "We have met the enemy and he is us," and thought, "I wish I could tell when that meeting took place because I missed it." His country's flag was still the same, but he had seen too many men and women, hypocrites all, standing before that flag and lying. Even his political science degree seemed a cruel trick, permitting him to perceive too much. And he stopped entertaining notions about fighting for a country in which he no longer seemed to have any rightful place. He had loaded the pistol at 3:30 a.m., alone in his den, 15 feet away from where we had shared coffee. He knew the sounds of fighter planes in the air, ours and theirs. What he was hearing then was not a police helicopter or semis crawling up the interstate. To make sure, he pulled out his hearing aid, and all that remained was a screeching noise that came from no kind of aircraft. Not even a Stuka bomber. This is guesswork, I know, but now I can see it. Clear as expensive stemware. An old man rips out his hearing aid, and the world falls silent. The mantel clock stops ticking, the outside world goes away, the creaks and settling lumber of his home cease their punctuation of the night, and he is left alone with the sound of the warbird. He finishes his bourbon, snubs his lucky, and pulls the trigger with closed and tearless eyes, hoping his sister will understand and forgive him. There is a loud noise, and the war comes pouring out of his head. Just another old fart, self-destructing. Except that now I can hear the sounds, too. Sounds that cannot be mistaken for anything else. Now I see strange black shapes in the night sky. Hungry, still unsatiated, coming back for more.
The Flying Machine by Ray Bradbury. After an early start writing effective and sometimes gruesome short stories of horror such as Small Assassin and The Emissary, Ray Bradbury grew to be one of the giants of 20th century fantasy fiction. He wrote one classic novel, Something Wicked This Way Comes, and his stories set in Greentown, Illinois, rival those of Sherwood Anderson about Winesburg, Ohio. In this tale, however, Bradbury takes us to ancient China and clearly delineates the dark side of flight in a mere 1,500 words. "Here is a man who has made a certain machine," the emperor says, "and yet asks us what he has created. He does not know himself." Ambrose Bierce's flying machine story is ironic. Bradbury's is allegorical, asking a deceptively simple question. Do we understand the implications of the things we create? Underlying this is another. Once created, can anything be uncreated?
The Flying Machine, read by Norbert Leo Butz.
In the year AD 400, the Emperor Yan held his throne by the Great Wall of China, and the land was green with rain, readying itself toward the harvest at peace, the people in his dominion neither too happy nor too sad. Early on the morning of the first day of the first week of the second month of the new year, the Emperor Yan was sipping tea and fanning himself against a warm breeze when a servant ran across the scarlet and blue garden tiles, calling, "Oh, Emperor! Emperor, a miracle!" "Yes," said the Emperor, "the air is sweet this morning." "No, no, a miracle," said the servant, bowing quickly. "And this tea is good in my mouth. Surely that is..."